Have you noticed that politicians struggle to enact the things they run on? That regardless of who wins elections, lawmakers cannot pass whatever legislation they like. They find themselves bound by what is popular, or at least their sense of it. They can only act within a narrow set of ideas, and that range is called the Overton Window. And on the Overton Window podcast, we look at issues around the country and talk to the people who change what is politically possible. Now, you never know what is going to resonate with people. And I'm happy to have someone on whose work resonated with me early. I started reading some of what George Leaf wrote back in 2002 when I was a freshman in college. His essays for the Foundation for Economic Education were part of a textbook on libertarian ideas. And I kept following him into his commentary on higher education for the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal. And he is also the author of two books, one on the right to work movement and the other a novel, The Awakening of Jennifer Von Arsdale. George, welcome.
No, glad to be on, James. Delighted.
How did you get into advocating for free markets?
It was my grandfather, I think, got me started. Back when I was about 11 or 12, he thought I ought to understand the world the way he did. And he started giving me things to read, articles from, or actually whole copies of National Review, for example, and there are newsletters from the National Right to Work Committee. So he got me thinking along the lines of less government is better when I was just about 12 years old. And I have never found anything to contradict that point of view, and much, much more evidence over the years that supports it.
I mean, once you started getting into these ideas when you're 12, what do you want to do with them? I mean, most people at 12 want to be, you know, firemen.
Yeah, I wanted to play baseball. I went to college kind of as a, oh, well, you know, it's a thing to do. And then not knowing exactly what else I wanted to do, I went to law school. And that, the best thing I learned in law school is I had been a square peg in round holes in the legal profession. So I decided not to do that. And eventually I kind of stumbled into a teaching career at Northwood, now Northwood University, right there in Midland. And I was there for nearly 10 years. And that was a pretty good experience, but also quite enlightening. And two key aspects. Enlightenment, number one, many of the students in college back in the 80s actually should have been in about fifth or sixth grade. I say that because they wrote like fifth or sixth graders. They didn't like to read. Getting to read anything was like pulling hen's teeth. And their writing was just appalling. Clearly, no one had paid any attention to their writing ability throughout their K-12 years. And I had lots of students complaining, oh, you make us write essays. We never had to take any of the true-false tests before. I could tell that the academic standards in K-12 had really gone downhill. Then I also learned something about what really drives higher education institutions. I was called on the carpet after 7 or 8 years of teaching because I was not being a good team player. And the gist of that complaint was, I was giving the students low grades, and they weren't happy about it. They could go someplace else, and that cost the school money. So I was told I have to make my courses more user-friendly, which, of course, really meant dumb them down, give the students high grades so they'll be happy. And at that point, I figured out that when higher education administrators talk about academic excellence, they're just paying lip service to that idea. What they really want are happy students who'll keep paying them money. I left after a bit short of 10 years. And it was the, you must dumb down your courses diktat that caused the burning of the bridge. And then I worked for a while in the state legislature in Michigan. And eventually I found this job posting here in Raleigh for someone to head up a brand new think tank which would focus on higher education issues, a spinoff of the John Locke Foundation. And they thought that I had about the right set of credentials for that, having taught and being kind of a skeptic about higher education. So I've been here ever since 1999, working on higher education issues for what is now called the James G. Martin Center.
Now, your work in the interim, you did start doing some policy engagement while you were a college professor, right? I believe.
Well, yes. Back in those days, I wrote a few pieces. There was no research requirement. Didn't have to write anything to stay on faculty, unlike a lot of schools where it's publish or perish. But I wrote some things anyway. One of my earliest interests was the right to work movement. I thought that right to work was a darn good policy. Let people opt out of unions if they don't like what they're getting. And so I wrote about that for the Mackinac Center in the Mackinac Center's very early days. And then later on, I got to know the people at the Right to Work, National Right to Work Committee. And in 2003, the president of the Right to Work Committee asked me if I would care to undertake a project for them. They wanted to have a book on the history of the Right to Work movement in time for their 50th anniversary in 2005. Did I want to do it? Well, yeah, I wanted to do it. It was quite a bit of work, but the book was published in 2005 entitled Free Choice for Workers and the History of the Right to Work Movement. And of course, Michigan has had its recent ups and downs in that respect, passing right to work back in, 2014 under Governor Snyder?
2012.
With, of course, the imprimatur of the Mackinac Center. And then when the Democrats retook everything, they kicked it back out, and so workers now have no escape hatch. If they don't like what their union does, if they think it doesn't support their point of view, if they think it's not working in their interest, too bad, you still have to keep on paying dues. And that's really the reason why I think right to work is so good. It gives workers an escape hatch, and that helps to keep the union bosses in line. If they know people can leave if they are just absconding with their money and not representing their interests, they'll do that. And so that's why right to work is a good policy.
So I do want to say you wrote about that, at least for the Mackinac Center, 1992. It was 20 years, and that was the first time anyone from the Mackinac Center had called for right to work. And, of course, we built on that, and we kept expounding upon that since you started for us. It took 20 years to actually pass right to work. And, of course, there's been other issues around the country. Michigan wasn't the only one. Indiana, West Virginia, a few other states.
Missouri.
Missouri, Wisconsin.
Wisconsin.
All passed right to work. In addition, the Supreme Court ruled that, at least in the public sector, for state and local government unions, they all had to recognize a person's right to work and abstain from paying union dues and agency fees. So how do you feel about the progress that's been made over that time?
Well, I think we've made good progress, with the exception of a few reversals, Michigan being key among them. And also, if I remember right, in Missouri, the unions ginned up a ballot initiative, and they're very good at winning those kinds of elections. They can pour out their supporters and flood the airways with the disinformation. And so they were able to reverse both in Michigan and Missouri, if that my memory serves me correctly. Nevertheless, union membership keeps shrinking. The union clout, I think, is less than it used to be. And I think people have come to accept that, yeah, unions don't always represent the people they claim to. They're oftentimes lining their own pockets. They're building political empires at the expense of workers. There's a much more generalized understanding that that is the truth of the matter than there used to be. And these unions just kind of have a halo that's very tarnished these days.
Well, and I still think the strongest point on right to work is probably the same thing that got you interested in the idea and into Doris in the first place, which is we live in a world of voluntary institution. Let's keep compulsion out of this. And keeping compulsion out of this is going to be good for workers. It's going to be good for unions too. And it's going to be good for employers in the public sector.
Yeah. It was a mistake ever to turn unionization into a political issue.
Mm-hmm.
In our early history, people could sign up if they wanted to, or they were free to not sign up if they didn't want to. Companies were free to negotiate with the unions if they felt it was in their interest to do so, or they could just say, no, I don't want to do business that way. Then the federal government stepped in and insisted that unions had some special right to represent workers, and if they won an election, everyone had to be in the union fold. No one could drop out and say, it's not for me. And that was a terrible mistake. We should go back to the days when the labor law was a matter of common law, matter of contract and tort.
Oh, I'm with you on.
Make the clock run back.
Let's make it run forward. That is the fundamental idea behind my colleague's efforts to try and call for 21st century unionization, where our associations within each other are based on voluntary exchange, mutually beneficial agreements, and advancing everyone's interests.
Yeah, there's no reason why unionization has to be a majority rule. You could have members-only unions. They would bargain for their members, and people who didn't want the union's representation would be free to do something else. And that would require undoing law and a Supreme Court decision in 1944. The union must represent everyone. Well, there's no reason why that should be that way.
Yeah. Yeah. Partial representation. There's all sorts of opportunities if we can get outside of the bounds that we've got right now. And I hope that we can start to have that conversation. Unfortunately, on the other side, unions have simply been, no, we want to double down on compulsion and coercion.
That's their whole game.
Yeah. But let's talk about higher education. So you went into the higher education advocacy space with some experience with higher education. You're commenting on it for decades now. Why higher education, or why have you stuck with it?
Kind of got into my soul that higher education was built up as such a wonderful investment for all young people, and it was a great elixir for the American economy to have more and more people go to college. And that got into me because it was so utterly false. Such a case of misleading people. We've been overselling higher education ever since the GI Bill. Many, many people have gone to college wasting time and money, learning little, and it's been getting worse over time. And the reason for that is because we make it so easy for everyone to go. And this was my own experience. It's easy for everyone to go to college. Politicians sold the idea that, oh, your life will be toast unless you go to college and get a degree. Obama said, we need to lead the world in the percentage of our people who have college degrees, and that'll boost our economy. And people will be healthier and wiser if they get college degrees. It was all such utter baloney. But people bought it. They bought into it. Parents would go into debt. To serious debt, and students, of course, themselves, to send the kids to college, even though the kids oftentimes had no interest and scant ability to do academic work. Many of them would spend their 4 or 5 or more years in college and then wind up doing the same kinds of jobs they could have done when they were still in high school. Mm-hmm. The idea that the more people go to college, the more jobs will be created for they require advanced knowledge. It's just not true. And that's why we have all these huge numbers of people. You know, going back, this is nothing new. Remember Occupy Wall Street back in 2011? College students complaining, oh, we have college debts and we can't find good jobs. Well, there was never any reason to think that just because we flood the market with people who have college credentials, there would be jobs for them. The kind of jobs they think they're entitled to. So that's what got me interested in it. Once I started looking into the literature on higher education, back when I started back in 1999 with the Martin Center, I found out that my jaundiced view was shared by a lot of other people. Many professors were saying that they had to dumb down their courses. The students were learning next to nothing. And then there was another nasty twist. Not only were they learning next to nothing, but many of the professors were using their courses as political soapboxes for indoctrination of students. They were trying to turn out new generations of radicals, and they were somewhat successful at that. A lot of students would go into college already feeling from their high school years like, oh, we want to be activists. Well, they'd get in with these professors who would push them over the edge. And we've seen how that turned out in the last couple of years. These radical students who are really quite vicious in their views. They don't want to hear anything that contradicts their notions about the world.
The oppressive progressive.
Yes. And they seek to silence anyone who disagrees or even get physically confrontational with them. So we've been doing a lot of bad things by subsidizing higher education. If we could ever undo that, that would be part of a big step in the along the road to restoring America.
What do you bring to the higher education debate?
An utterly radical point of view.
Yes, I'm hearing.
Just about everyone still believes the idea that college education is ennobling and uplifting, and it's required for so many jobs. Well, actually, no, it's not. There are very, very few jobs that couldn't possibly be done by an intelligent high school graduate who would learn what it requires. There's almost nothing in college, with very few exceptions, even some scientific disciplines that you couldn't possibly do just based on your knowledge of science from high school. But aside from a few jobs like that, almost everything a smart high school student could learn to do the work. There's nothing magic about going to college, except that it means wasting several years of your life and piling up a whole lot of debt and listening to a lot of radicalized professors. So what I've been arguing for a long time is we need to get the government out of subsidizing higher education. Get rid of the student loan mess. Stop with the Pell Grants. Let higher education institutions figure out how to act like businesses, provide the benefits that people are willing to pay for with their own money. And that would cause things to change dramatically.
All right. So what you are doing is fighting against the massive social tendency that is like everyone's parents seems to believe that their kids should go to college, that the idea that college is the ticket to the middle class is something that is firmly ingrained. And I am with you that these are assumptions that are mistaken. It is very difficult to change them. So what are you doing?
Well, actually, I disagree with you there.
All right.
They were firmly ingrained, but the last 5 years, I think they have, the ground is shifting. Lots and lots of people are now questioning the value of college. One reason for that is that employers are now questioning the value of college. Quite a few have said, look, we used to say you had to have a college degree to apply for a job with us. A lot of them have backed away from that. And big companies too, like Google, for example. What they're looking at is not whether you have a piece of paper that says you graduated with enough credits. They want to see evidence that you have the abilities they're looking for. And then, of course, the employers are also starting to realize that college imbues young people with some really heavy baggage. I recently read a book, fascinating book, titled Who Needs College Anymore? And the author interviewed a lot of employers, and she found some of them saying, yeah, I just don't want college graduates. I want people who want to learn my business. people who I can train, people have a little bit of loyalty to me. They've soured on college. And there are many other ways now for people to obtain the evidence that they are employable, that they have ambition, that they have skills. Besides, that are actually, not besides, but if superior to your own college BA. Her book, now Kathleen Delasky is her name, her book, Who Needs College Anymore, is full of these stories of the alternatives that are popping up rapidly for people to obtain the skills that they need without spending 4 years piling up debts in college, taking a lot of courses that are of no interest to them, a lot of courses that are actually bad for them to take. So I think the country may be in for a radical change. That old mentality you mentioned about college is essential for success, I think that is fading, and it's going to fade faster and faster.
What's been your most successful fight so far?
Most successful fight. Well, we've won a few fights here in the state of North Carolina. For instance, getting college curricula online so people can find out what's actually being taught at these colleges. Sunlight is the great disinfectant, as Justice Brandeis observed, and that's true in college. A lot of the colleges would rather you not know. In fact, they've even sometimes tried to keep secret what is going on in their classrooms. The Martin Center fought for legislation in North Carolina so that in the public schools, at least in this state, public colleges in this state, there has to be transparency. And that's a darn good thing.
That's especially important in places. I mean, these are state institutions. They are run by and for the people of North Carolina. People should know what's going on in there.
Yes.
What have you learned from not yet successful fights?
Not yet successful fights. Well, the biggest not yet successful fight is the fight to get the government out of funding higher education, subsidizing higher education.
Mm-hmm.
That was one of the greatest mistakes the country ever made. There's nothing in the Constitution that says the government has any role whatsoever in education at any level. It was a terrible blunder that we ever got into subsidizing higher education with student loans and grants. There are a few of us who are arguing that we need to get the government out. What we're up against is an enormous industry that wants the easy money to keep on flowing. The only reason that I'm at least optimistic that at some point we might be able to turn off the flow is the point I just mentioned, that people are growing skeptical that higher education is really a good value. And so we may at some point be able to convince them that the government is piling up enormous debts, unpaid student debts, for a project that's really a bad project, a useless project that doesn't lead to skill.
Counterproductive project.
It's a counterproductive project. If enough people come to realize that, I think the Overton window may open up enough that we could say, look, the government should never have gotten into lending in the first place. Let's phase it out. I think that is possible. That may be possible in the next decade or two.
All right, so let's talk about the Overton window, because I think people don't even know all the policies that are going on here, which is states give state universities blanket sums of money, some based on a formula, some not. Some of those formulas are good. Some of those formulas are not so good. We give students scholarships directly. We guarantee, the federal government guarantees student loans. Some of those, sometimes they say you don't have to pay those back.
Yeah.
There's all sorts of different another one, just community colleges get property taxes. And I don't know if any state universities do or not. And even with all of that, tuition still tends to keep growing. I mean, some people argue that look, part of that's the weird progressive discounts they give to people. The institutions keep growing. It's It's the blob that absorbs all that it touches.
Yes, but the bubble is deflating. Mm-hmm. The peak college percentage of young people going to college, it peaked in 2010. It's been falling ever since. It's fallen significantly. And I think it's going to continue. It's going to continue to fall, and at a rapid pace, a more rapid pace, because, as I mentioned earlier, people are figuring out that college is not a great investment and that there are much better ways to prepare for the labor force than going and spending four or five or more years trying to earn a college degree. As that realization dawns on more and more people, the colleges won't have the leverage that they did in the past to continue raking in the subsidies. It'll be possible for colleges to say no to them, which was not possible 10, 15 years ago. I think that's going to become the new normal. Now they'll go hat in hand and say, please give us money. And then colleges say, nope. Voters don't want that anymore.
That's a great point, because right now, the reputation is what protects them most, which is, okay, we'll give you some more money, maybe not a lot here and there, but we're definitely not going to cut it. People aren't going to like the sound of that. But when you change people's minds, if their idea of higher education being a vast waste of time and money for the people involved, then the politics around that changes. The Overton window shifts, and these things that were politically impossible become inevitable.
Yes, and a good side point to that is that the colleges that manage to survive will do so because they will go back to offering a sound educational value. They'll cut out the politicized junk and go back to offering the kinds of real academic coursework that used to be the pillar of a college education. Real coursework that isn't dumbed down, that isn't suffused with politics. That'll be the kind of things that people will be willing to pay for. Colleges that figure out how to do that will survive.
Is it going to be in response to student demands?
Students and their parents. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. If you read that book, Who Needs College Anymore, you find that a lot of young people in high school are realizing, college is an option for me, but I'm going to look at other things. And a lot of smart young kids in high school are finding apprenticeships. They're finding these online credentialing programs, certificate programs that lead to real skills. And they're getting jobs at the age of 20, 21, earning real money instead of sitting in a college classroom, being bored stiff, and piling up debts.
Will colleges be able to offer affordable and effective degrees again?
Some of them will, and those that don't, adios.
So that's a point that I think is really interesting, and I want to dig in on, because what you're saying is there is competition that exists. There is a marketplace for higher education. There are institutions that are competing with each other for resources. Now, all of this has been manipulated, manipulated by governments and perpetuated by governments. But there is a demand for students, and there are competing institutions. And as long as students change what they demand, there's going to be something. It's going to wind up being different, but these are institutions that are going to survive and thrive, even without government assistance.
Well, I think you're right. That's something to look forward to. If the government had never set foot in the realm of higher education, we would be so, so much better off today. And I think it's feasible that we'll eventually be able to get out of the quicksand before it engulfs us.
How are you optimistic about colleges being able to do that?
Yes. It's Schumpeterian creative destruction is finally going to be unleashed on the college sector. And a lot of them won't figure out how to offer, the faculty probably say, well, we're not going to do that. We don't want to just train kids to work in business. You know, we're above that. Well, they'll find themselves with no paying customers anymore. And that'll be a good thing. Creative destruction. What made America great? The things that don't work get wiped out by the things that do. College is about to experience what creative destruction is like.
George, good luck on your efforts to shift the Overton window.
Well, thank you. We're going to keep trying. That's what the Martin Center is all about.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Overton Window, a podcast from the Mackinac Center. Please subscribe and rate. For more, check us out at www.mackinac.org. That's Mackinac with a C, like the island.